Welcome to Lectionary Bites, a podcast for the busy pastor, the bogged down student, and the curious biblical scholar. Each short episode features different professors and students from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, narrowing in on an insight or two from the assigned scripture readings from the week. We hope these bites can support your sermon prep, spark new ideas and connections, and help you meditate on God's word throughout your busy week. Lectionary Bites is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.
Welcome back to Lectionary Bites. My name is Ben Leeper. I am a seminary student here at Concordia Seminary. I'm in my fourth year, and perhaps by the time this is airing, I will have graduated with my MDiv degree, and I'm joined by Kurt.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Kurt Helwig, and I'm also a fourth-year student, and by the time this is airing, I may be out in the parish and ordained, but you'll still be here, Ben, because you're doing an STM, is that right?
Yeah, that's the plan. I'm going to stick around and do some additional grad work in the systematics department.
Very cool. But today we're talking about Acts 1, especially the choosing of Matthias to replace Judas. And so you can kind of talk for quite a bit about how Matthias was chosen. You may remember that the apostles, the other 11, cast lots, and that's how Matthias became an apostle. That's a whole topic of conversation right there. But off to the other side, you have a narrative bit where Luke says what happens to Judas and talks about the demise of Judas. But you also have Peter cite these two psalms, Psalm 69 and Psalm 109, as again an explanation of what happened with Judas. These psalms are about Christ and they are about his work. You would think maybe that the most quoted passages from the Old Testament and the New Testament would be something like Isaiah 53, and that's certainly there, or even like the Genesis narratives. But the Psalms are the most quoted book in the New Testament, appearing in almost every New Testament book except for a few. And in particular, there are some Psalms that really show up, Psalm 110, Psalm 118, and then one of those Psalms we're going to look at today, which is Psalm 69.
Yeah. So this is a psalm of individual lament. The psalm is attributed to David, and it's describing him within a position where he's being kind of falsely accused and assaulted by others. Now, within this psalm, David's coming to the Lord and saying, you know, search me, know my faults, look at my sins, but also look at what these accusers are saying about me. There's the reference in verse 4, more in number than the hairs of my head are those who hate me without cause, which is also used in reference to Jesus. Jesus also uses or is connected to verse 9, for zeal of your house has consumed me. But the verse which really comes into play for us here is later on when we have verse 25, which is, may there camp be a desolation, let no one dwell in their tents. And this is part of this section of the psalm that is incredibly imprecatory. And imprecatory is a term that we use when we're talking about the psalms to refer to passages which are speaking judgment against the enemies of God, or asking God to judge and bring his righteousness and justice into the situation, specifically against a human enemy. And so who this human enemy is for David, we don't know. But the language is quite strong. This may that can't be a desolation is probably the weakest of the things that could be mentioned. We also have let their eyes be darkened so they cannot see, make their loins tremble continually. Later on, I find this particularly disturbing. Let them be blotted out of the book of the living. Let them not be enrolled among the righteous. So how can David speak this way? What does this have to do for us? And how can we possibly be reading Jesus into this psalm?
How we move from David to Jesus in the psalm beyond the direct reference in Acts is a great question. I think this psalm really establishes David and Jesus as kind of a type and anti-type. So David is here a king who is, despite his power, nevertheless feels weak and feels the need to kind of lash out at his enemies here. And while New Testament authors put these words in the mouth of Jesus, we know it was ultimately Jesus who facing much greater enemies, overcame them, whereas the resolution of the David narrative is unclear.
Now, also significantly, the New Testament authors attach a specific enemy to this attribution of this psalm to Jesus as well. The Acts 1 reading is really about them connecting Judas as the enemy of this imprecatory psalm. And the reason they can do that is because they have in other places connected this psalm as a whole to Jesus. And so because they're reading Jesus as the afflicted, innocent one of the psalm, they also feel that it's appropriate to read the primary enemy of the psalm as Judas.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, Judas is mentioned in a number of New Testament passages tied to the psalms. And we'll get to Psalm 109 in a second, but Psalm 41, actually, Jesus himself, in speaking of Judas, goes on to say that even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted his heel against me. And he says this in John 13, I believe, at the Last Supper. And so, you know, again, you have a psalm lament where Jesus reads himself as the psalmist and Judas as the enemy.
I think one of the points that we can draw from this is it's not just the apostles who see Jesus and Judas in the Psalms. It's Jesus himself who ultimately sees himself and Judas within these imprecatory Psalms. And in a way, these Psalms become the prayers of Jesus. And we're going to come back to that idea later. But before we do that, I want to go and switch over to the other Psalm that's referenced, Psalm 109. Now, this Psalm is quite extreme in its language. This is another individual lament or possibly an individual complaint. And in this one, the innocence of the speaker is again highlighted. But the middle section of the psalm, I believe from verses 6 to 20, are some of the strongest imprecatory language in the psalms. Dr. Seleska, in his psalms commentary, actually highlights both Psalm 69 and Psalm 109 as some of the harshest examples of imprecatory language.
Absolutely. And it's sort of debated in scholarship whether the words of verse 6 through verse 20 are the words of the psalmist or are those the words of those who are accusing the psalmist. And I think this is kind of a maybe nice way of trying to get out of having to explain how those words could be the words of the psalmist. But maybe unfortunately for our purposes, it seems pretty grammatically clear that those are indeed the words of the psalmist and see in Acts the words of Christ himself.
Right. So we can't really wiggle out of this, unfortunately. And just to give you kind of a sampling of the type of language that we're talking about, verse 9, may his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. Later on, may the iniquity of his fathers be remembered before the Lord, and let not the sin of his mother be blotted out. There's a reference there to kind of Exodus 20. Where God talks about remembering the sins of those who disobey him for two and three generations, but forgiving the sins of those who follow him for 1,000. So we have this reference where he's saying, hold the sins of the father against this person.
Yeah, so to what degree is the psalmist able to say this? Because the original author is unclear. And then to what degree, more problematically, can like it actually be Christ who says these words?
Right. So once again, we're looking at this through the lens of Jesus and his life. And this psalm, both of these psalms, become rather personal and rather specific through the lens of Judas. We have that, let another take his office in verse 8, which Acts 1 specifically references. So I think the question of how can Jesus pray these, how can Jesus be in these? Well, I think the first thing we want to do is see Jesus as the innocent one in the line of David in these psalms. And this shows up with Psalm 22 as well, which is another famous messianic psalm. So Jesus is the one who is afflicted. He is the one who is wrongly accused, which was a really common theme in both these. He's the one who's betrayed. Once again, a common theme in both of these psalms. And so Jesus is the one who is enduring the things which this psalmist is talking about. And in a way, the psalmist's suffering become a prelude and kind of a foreshadowing of Jesus's ultimate suffering, where he, the true innocent one, is accused of a crime that he did not commit. He is accused of being a sinner, which he is not. And he is persecuted by those who hate him. And ultimately, he is killed for it. So I think that's one of the ways that we can kind of see Jesus within these psalms.
Yes. As regards like the original psalmist saying this, we're also not told, go and do likewise. You know, it's more recorded for our learning than our imitation. But that big question, though, is like, can Jesus actually say these, you know, shocking words that we hear? And the answer is ultimately yes, because only God is capable of righteous anger.
Right. It's not something that humans are really ever capable of doing sinlessly. We have numerous New Testament passages which call us to love our enemies, as well as numerous New Testament passages such as Mark 7, which even explicitly condemn anger. And by this, we're not really getting after anger as like a felt emotion entirely, because that is a part of the human experience. But when that becomes directed at another person, that becomes sin.
And for those of you listening, if you have more questions about this, Dr. Gibbs had an article in the Concordia Journal a few years ago that really fleshes this out and got quite a response kind of church-wide.
Right. So if you're uncomfortable with this language, good. You probably should be. You probably shouldn't be reading this and saying, ah, yes, they got what they deserved. Like, you should be uncomfortable because as a Christian, that's not how we are called to live. And there were Old Testament prohibitions against anger and for loving the enemy as well. So you mentioned that it's ultimately Jesus and only Jesus that can kind of pray this way.
Yes, because Jesus as God is the one who is a judge of the living and the dead and ultimately will bring about justice on evildoers. And in the case of the psalm, those who falsely accuse or slander others. But in his commentary on the psalm, Bonhoeffer brings about an amazing and evangelical twist on this where he says, yes, Jesus, you know, here is speaking these words against Judas, and Jesus is the righteous judge, but Jesus is also the one who, in taking the sin of the whole world upon himself, takes these very curses that he speaks and experiences those on the cross. And so Jesus is both the righteous avenger of God and also the one who experiences the vengeance and wrath of God on and in our behalf. And even in the behalf of Judas, had Judas believed. So
I think that is probably one of the most helpful insights for me for helping to read and even pray these really difficult imprecatory psalms. I've got a quote from Bonhoeffer here in his meditation on the psalms, in which he said, no one other than he who himself bore the wrath of God could pray like this. God hates and judges the enemies of God in the only righteous one, the one who prays for forgiveness of God's enemies. And this is kind of like the application of that idea that you were mentioning, Kurt, that because Jesus is both the innocent one and the one who ultimately bears the wrath of God, we can take our wrath, we can take our anger, and we can take that to God, knowing that he can handle it and that he can take it and that he dealt with it through his son on the cross. And I think in a very personal way, if you're finding yourself very empathetically relating to these psalms, because maybe you are being persecuted, especially for the faith, or maybe you are in a situation where it really does feel like everyone is out to get you without cause, and you find yourself relating to this language, we can actually pray this with Jesus, knowing that he takes that language, he takes that anger, and he actually directs it towards himself. And he takes it on himself on the cross. And through that, he kills it. He kills that wrath. He kills that anger. And all that's left is the grace and forgiveness that he gives us to then share with the neighbor. And I think sometimes we hear these commands in the New Testament to love our enemies, to not hate. And we ask ourselves, how can we do this? And I actually think the imprecatory psalms are a great way through Christ that this actually becomes something possible. This isn't just some impossible command that's there to show us how sinful we are. Rather, when we can actually take that anger to God, he does something with it and he kills it and brings alive grace. He turns us back towards our enemies, having taken that wrath on himself, and says, that's paid for. Now give them grace.
Absolutely. So as we kind of wrap up here, what's maybe one question you want to leave the listeners with?
I think here's the question that I'd like for our listeners to ponder for this week. When you read the Psalms, how do you read them through Christ? Is Christ right there in the text? Is he one of the characters of the Psalms? Is he being alluded to prophetically? Does he seem far and distant from the text as the imprecatory language at first seems? Is he reigning over creation, as in these Psalms of majesty? Where is Jesus in the psalm? And then where are you? Are you distant from this, far away? I would never feel this way. Are you right there with the psalmist? And how can we start to pray these psalms with the original authors through Christ?
If you enjoyed Lectionary Bites, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Facebook so that you don't miss a single episode. This podcast is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.